Right, welcome everyone again. Last year, actually probably for the last 18 months or so, I've been doing a series on the Messianic Psalms. It's with sadness or possible joy that I announce that that has come to an end. So new year and a new sort of study, a new series that I wanted to look at for I don't know how long it'll go, but I wanted to look at some of the heroes of the Bible. Kind of as a society, we kind of like our heroes. You know, we like to hero worship, if you like. I was trying to think about who was my first hero. And probably the first person that I came up with, probably when I was probably about six or seven, it was slightly odd. It was Colonel George Armstrong Custer of the U.S. Cavalry. kind of liked my cowboys and Indians back at that stage. And liked the Indians too, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse. But George Armstrong Custer, I thought he was pretty cool. And one time I got my pocket knife out and I had a dresser right next to my bed at home, and I engraved his name in this dresser. You know, I don't think you really wanted to sell that again, did you? No. All good. All right, but today obviously is no different. People love to sort of to hero worship. Kind of moved on a little bit maybe from cowboys and Indians. Kind of like our heroes to be super these days. As in all the superheroes that are getting pumped out by Hollywood, whether it be, you know, Batman or Superman or Iron Man, or I think one of the latest is that Colossus Ant-Man. Yes. It's not just make-believe. We sort of like to hero worship real people. Kind of, you might remember what it was like when Obama was running for president in 2008. And the media especially, like, just basically worshipped him. In 2013, Barbara Walters, who does a lot of those interviews, I think either on 2020 or 60 Minutes, but she interviews a lot of so-called famous people, she was talking and she said, we, the media, thought that he was going to be, and I shouldn't say this at Christmas time, but the next Messiah. So they literally thought that he was going to be the next Messiah. And they put him up on this massive pedestal. Today, people are oohing and aahing actually about the Pope. You might have seen it when he went to America last year. In one of the English newspapers, The Guardian, they had the title, Atheists Love Pope Francis. It's kind of saying something. The subheading was, the Pope ignites unprecedented secular excitement. So they're now putting him up on this pedestal. So here we go again. All right. But when you come to the Bible, it's not without its list of heroes as well. But it's fair to say that they're a totally different type of character. Totally different. So what I wanted to actually start in this sort of new series, that long-winded introduction, is basically just to say I want to actually look at a series on some of the characters in Hebrews 11, which is kind of like God's hall of faith. It's who he thinks is actually a hero, if you like. And like I said, heroes for totally different reasons than what the world would pick. So see if... this morning is really just going to be an introduction. We're probably not even going to get on to the first hero, but we're only going to look at the first three verses of Hebrews 11. But as we work through the series, we'll start introducing some of these characters. So you tell me who these characters would be. Firstly, one of the heroes would be a lowly shepherd boy who became a king. David. Yep. There's also a would-be king who gave it all up and became a shepherd. A would-be king or maybe I should call him a prince who gave it all up and became a shepherd. Moses. Yeah. There is the despised brother, hated and sold into slavery. Joseph. And what about the other brother who was literally left for dead by his own brother? Was that?
Abel.
Absolutely. Okay. What about that reluctant hero, the one who said he was least in his family and whose family was least in their tribe that God used to save the nation of Israel? Gideon. Yeah. Or the preacher of righteousness who saved no one outside his own family. Noah. And let's not forget the harlot who put her life on the line to save God's people. Rahab. Yeah. So there's a whole lot more. This is just a few of them. A whole lot of these lists of stars, if you like. And God actually kind of ends Hebrews 11 by saying that the world was not worthy of these ones. World was not worthy of them. Let me just read a quote that I found as I was studying this. It was by an American author and poet, a guy called Henry David Thoreau. He wrote the following, and just think about this. He said, "If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away." I'll just say it again because it's actually quite a good quote. It says, "If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away." Because that sums up these characters that we're going to look at in Hebrews 11. You know, they listened and they marched to a different drummer. They heard a different music, if you like. But hopefully that can kind of be said of our own lives as well. You know, we should actually be listening to a different drummer and we should be walking to a different beat to those in the world. All right, so let's have a look at Hebrews 11, just these first few verses. It really touches on kind of just an initial definition of faith. And it goes into the first aspect of faith. So it says, Hebrews 11, it says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old gained approval. And by faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of the things which are visible." So Hebrews 11 as a whole chapter is far more practical than theoretical. It doesn't spend a lot of time sort of going into some theological discussion about the ins and outs of faith. It would rather demonstrate what faith is by giving a whole lot of examples of how people lived by faith. But it actually does start just in that first verse with probably the only definition of faith that you'll get in the Bible that I know of. Very simple. It says, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." I'm not sure how you would define faith if you're asked. Maybe if an unbeliever said, "Well, what is faith?" There was a little girl that they asked to define faith, and she said, "Well, faith is believing what you know ain't so." And we can kind of understand that that's kind of how the world sees faith. It's just believing what you know ain't so. It's not really, really real, but you just sort of, it's just faith, you know, you just believe. That's not biblical faith. And biblical faith isn't positive thinking, you know, everything's going to be alright, everything. Yeah. Oops. It's not a wishy-washy hope, like, "Oh, look, I just hope that things kind of turn out okay." Those are not faith. Faith is far more sure than that. That's why in the very start there it says, Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. So it's pretty certain. Pretty certain. So it's not just a I hope that it doesn't rain today or something like that. It's not biblical hope. And we see that it's actually linked to hope. It's the assurance of things hoped for. So it's linked to future hopes that we have. But a biblical hope is based on the promises of God, which is based on the character of God. So it's something that is sure. As you go on in Hebrews 11, you find all these examples of people who actually had this future hope, and they were so assured of this hope that it actually changed how they lived their life here and now. You know, you read of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and it talks about how they were actually looking for a heavenly city. And they were so assured of that heavenly city that they were able to actually call themselves and be strangers and exiles in this land. They were able to sort of leave what they knew because they were looking for the city whose builder is God. So they had this future hope that was so certain that it impacted how they live today. And this faith, it brings light, if you like, even to the darkest of times, the darkest of circumstances. I was reading the story a little while back of Adoniram Judson. Have you guys heard of him? Who was he, or what did he do? Yeah. So he was an American missionary, fairly much the first missionary to Burma, and he served there for 40 years. And early on, he was well liked. He even had favour with the king of Burma. But in 1824, as I was reading about it, there was an impending war between Burma and England. And basically, all of a sudden, anyone that was white was just held with suspicion. And then the suspicion grew to arrests. And they came into his home, arrested him, and they took him to what they called, I think I wrote it down, they called it an infamous vermin-ridden death prison of Ava. They threw him into this prison, put his feet in shackles, had chains, and they would actually put this bamboo, a solid piece of bamboo, through all the chains so that you're actually linked to all the other prisoners. And at night, they would come and they would actually lift this bamboo up so that it was off the air. So your feet are up on the air and your shoulders can just basically balance on the ground. So you spend the whole night with these shackles and these chains weighing down your feet while you're fairly much upside down. And I was reading about that, and it was pretty full on. It was like hideous heat, just a lot of darkness, terrible. And at one point, when I was reading this, it said a fellow prisoner who wasn't a believer, he said with a sneer on his face, he said, "Dr. Judson, what now about the prospect of the conversion of the heathen?" So he was, you know, taking the opportunity to sort of get a little dig in, sort of mock, you know, what are you going to do now kind of thing. What now about the prospect of the conversion of the heathen? And it said Judson's instant reply was, "The prospects are just as bright as the promises of God." So even in that darkest situation, faith allowed him to actually rise up above it all. And we know from history that he went on and you know, did amazing things in Burma and especially to the Karen, brought the message of the gospel to the Karen. And even today, you know, Fraser's been there, others have been there, that the Karen are still holding to that Christian faith in the midst of, you know, persecution. Yeah. So it's faith that says is the assurance of things hoped for. It's certain based on the promises of God. But also says the conviction of things not seen. So it's actually saying that the believer is one that that has to live in this world with more than just our natural eyes. We actually have to be able to learn to see the unseen. It's the conviction of things not seen. And it's hard for those in the world to actually grasp and accept these things. I remember I had a pretty staunch atheist who wrote into the website saying, all right, give us your best proof that God exists. You know, give us your best kind of proof. And he was sort of mocking it. He sort of thought that the Bible was on the same level as fairy tales and myths, you know. And it's actually hard to prove someone that obviously doesn't want to see and cannot see and only goes by their senses. And so I tried to talk about my conversion, my life as a Christian, the times I've experienced God. That just got fairly much rubbished. Possibly I told them about Bible prophecy, which I think worked a little bit better in terms of that's something that's you can actually prove it a little bit more. But a lot of the things to do with what God offers us, they can't be seen with your natural eyes. I read, just to get a little bit of a side note, but I read this kind of slightly amusing thing. There was an atheist and he was talking to a Quaker. And he said, have you seen your God? He said, have you touched your God? He said, have you smelt your God? He said, and you say you have a God. And it said the Quaker, he thought for quite a long time. There was quite a long pause. And he said, hast thou ever seen thy brains? Hast thou ever touched thy brains? Hast thou ever smelt thy brains? And thou sayest thou hast brains. I thought that was quite amusing. Yeah. But we understand from an unbeliever's point of view that the promises of God are not something that you can physically touch as such. If you said to an unbeliever, I've been given forgiveness by God, he's given me a gift of righteousness, and they say, well, where is it? You know, these things are actually, when you become a Christian, you don't get a certificate to say, you know, Ian Gordon is now hereby pardoned and forgiven. These promises of God are not things that we actually can see with our physical eyes, but through faith, like it says here, it's a conviction of the things not seen. We can actually grasp those things that are not seen, and they actually become so real that the peace that comes with them and the joy that comes with them, you do experience. All right. And that's the kind of faith that all of these people in Hebrews 11 were commended for. They're all commended for it. In verse 2 it says that. It says, for by it, that is faith, the men of old gained approval. You know, as we move forward through this series, we're going to see that there's all sorts of people in Hebrews 11. They had all sorts of strengths and weaknesses, but they all had that same common denominator, that they actually lived by faith. And they had all sorts of different testings, I guess, of that faith. If you think of Abel, his faith talks about righteousness that comes by faith. He offered up the sacrifice, you know, not of his own works, blood sacrifice. Enoch, it says, had to walk with God. He had this consistent walk of faith. Noah, his faith was obeying God, standing alone, even in the midst of opposition. You know, it talks about Abraham had to actually give up the comforts that he knew and left, not knowing where he was going to go, walked by faith. Sarah had to believe the impossible, and she did. Moses had many testings. One of them was to even overcome his own sense of inadequacy and weakness and to trust God. And he did by faith. David, you could say, had one giant problem, but overcame it through faith. And we could carry on. So hopefully, hopefully you can see yourself in these characters, because you'll be going through something. If I kind of went through, you know, and pointed to different people, I bet everyone here has got something that they are having to trust God for and walk in faith for, right at the moment. And it may be totally different to what we've read about so far, but it'll be something that God is asking you to walk in faith in. And it's not a walk in the park, this life of faith. You know, our faith is tested and it is tried. Let me just read a quote by Martin Luther. He said, "Faith sees the invisible, it believes the incredible, and it receives the impossible. Then it accepts the impossible, does without the indispensable, and bears the intolerable." So the start of that sounding all real good. Last part of it, not so much. Faith sees the impossible. Yes, wonderful faith. It does without the indispensable. I'd rather not. It receives the impossible. Hooray! Give me more. It bears the intolerable. Do we have to? But we actually see that even in this chapter of faith, in the characters that we're going to talk about. You know, it talks about how some by faith quenched the power of fire and shut the mouths of lions. Hooray! Others, it said, were stoned and sawn in two and received not what was promised. And that was still done by faith. It says, by faith women received back their dead by resurrection. We like the sound of that. Others, by faith, it says, were tortured, not accepting their release so that they might obtain a better resurrection. Eek. So faith is not a walk in the park. It has wonderful victories, but it has wonderful and difficult testings as well. George Mueller. You probably all heard of George Mueller. He kind of was a man who knew a thing or two about living by faith, looking after all the orphans and not basically telling anybody about his needs, only God. He said this. He said, "God delights to increase the faith of his children." We like the sound of that. All of us would like to have our faith increased. He says, "I say, and I say it deliberately, trials, difficulties, and sometimes defeat are the very food of faith. And we should take them out of the hands as evidence of his love and care for us in developing more and more of that faith which he is seeking to strengthen in us." So he says, "I say it, and I say it deliberately, trials, difficulties, sometimes defeat are the very food of faith." That's what faith lives on, to actually be strengthened. Yeah. All right. But it says in verse 2, "For by it," and that's faith. And actually, as you read through chapter 11, that word, by faith, it's actually mentioned 18 times. By faith, he did this. By faith, this person did that. By faith, they did that. By faith, the men of old and the women were gained approval. All right, verse 3. So we come now to, I guess, the first aspect that all of us hopefully can put our names next to. It may be that when you read Hebrews 11, you think, well, you know, my faith is a little bit pipsqueak compared to these great men of old and all the things that they did. If that's the case, hopefully, I believe, you'll still be able to put your name into verse 3. It says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible." So we come basically to like this very first step in the walk of faith. You know, and it used to be a very simple step to take. This used to be a simple step. It's not so simple for a lot of people in the West today. But this first step is basically understanding and believing by faith that there is a God who actually created all things that we see out of nothing. Out of nothing. I remember late last year I was taking kids' church, and while I was talking about God and his character and how he's the creator, and Caleb said, "Yeah, but where did God come from?" And Ezra piped up straight away. He said, "Yeah, well, who created God?" And so I gave this sort of little, I don't know if you call it a theological answer. I was trying to keep it as simple as possible, saying it's difficult for us to understand. Everything we know has a creator. It's hard for us to know, but God is eternal, you know, and blah, 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 carried on. And then Elia said, yeah, but where did God come from? I was like, okay, all right. You win, I lose. You've defeated me. There's some things that are too hard for our brains. We hit this block wall, if you like, a brick wall, about the eternal nature of God. And yet, though, as I said, in the past, everyone just about, even those that weren't really, you know, Christians, they could still accept that there was a God who actually has created the things that we see. You know, in Romans it says, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. So basically it's saying, okay, you don't need to know anything else apart about God, apart from if you can just look at creation, you can see the design, you should know that there's a designer. If you see creation, you should know that there is a creator. You know, there's no coded system that we have that actually doesn't have a coder, if you like. And now, you know, as they delve down into the DNA and they see all the intricate, basically, programming, coding that's in there, people should know there's got to be a coder, the creator and his creation. You know, science can answer a lot of things. I did a science degree at university, probably not as well as some, but I got my science degree. Science can tell us a lot of things. We can learn heaps of things from science, but there is key questions it can't go into. It can't even begin to answer. It can't tell us how we actually got here, how life originated. It can't tell us what the purpose of life is. It can't tell us what's wrong with the heart of man. It can't tell us really what are good morals. Can't even go into these things. Can't tell us what happens when we die. So basically, it can't tell us how we got here, what the purpose is, what's going to happen when you die. Some pretty key kind of questions. Science can't tell us any of these things. But in contrast, by faith, you actually know. I know who created me. I know why I'm here. I know where I'm going when I die. I know fairly much what he wants from me in this life. Sometimes make it, sometimes don't, but you know your purpose. That's what faith gives. That's what faith gives. And we can even, through our understanding and knowledge of the Bible, we can actually even understand the things that are to come. God's even revealed how things are going to end in this age. Faith can answer all of these questions that science can't even remotely get onto. But I just wanted to look at this verse 3 in a slightly different way. So it's saying that by faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God. So basically, as we read in Genesis, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and there was darkness over the face of the earth, and God said, "Let there be light." That was God's wonderful act of creation. But in a sense, this verse 3 actually also reminds us of a different act of creation, and it actually gives us meaning for what we're going to see in the rest of the chapter. Because yes, it talks about a God who made something out of nothing, but that's actually not his greatest act of creation. His greatest act of creation is being able to turn you and me into a new creation. To actually not just create something out of nothing, but someone out of a nobody, if you like. You know, Paul, he talked about this in 2 Corinthians. He knew that that first little act of creation where God said, "Let there be light," was actually talking also, pointing to actually what God's done in our lives. He just said this, he said, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." So by faith we understand that God created all of that to begin with, but also through faith comes the new creation, which is God's greatest miracle. All right, I just wanted to actually, we're not going to go too much further, but there was a passage in 1 Peter, very well known. Maybe we'll just turn to that and we'll read it. And I just wanted to bring out maybe 3 points about faith in general. 1 Peter 1. It's a great, great passage in 1 Peter 1, starting verse 3. So it says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time." So all of that is very, very, very good news. Very good news. It says that we will attain an inheritance, imperishable, won't fade away, it's reserved in heaven, how we are protected by faith. Protected by the power of God through faith. And then it talks about for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. And then it goes back to fairly much today. It says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now, for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls." Kind of as I read that, there was just sort of 3 real quick things. You can't do justice to the whole passage because there's so much in it. But there's just 3 little things I just wanted to basically conclude on to do with faith. First of all, your faith will need to be proved. That's what it says there. It says, "So that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may found to result in praise and glory." So if you feel like your faith is being proved or being tested, it's very normal. I remember as a young Christian, I sort of was learning about the faith, you know, devouring the Bible, learning about all these things, the really, really great stuff, how to live as a Christian. And, you know, you have little tiny tests, but probably my biggest test came when I was really sick for fairly much the whole year in 1997. And boy, did I flunk the test, basically. Kind of found out that, you know, that, yeah, it's one thing to learn about faith. It's a whole different thing to actually be tested and actually have to live by it. But it's not an unusual thing. That's just the first point. Your faith will need to be proved. It will need to be proved. The second thing is, it says that your faith is actually precious. I don't know whether you think of your faith as something that is really precious. It says it's more precious than gold. That's how God sees it, and that's also how we should see it. And so we need to actually guard against anything that would seek to diminish our faith, you know, to guard against those that would actually try to steal our faith. God says that your faith is something incredibly precious. Incredibly precious. And you can be assured, unfortunately, that anything that's precious to God will come under attack by the enemy, because he hates God. And he hates anything that's precious to God. Just the last thing I wanted to say from here. So firstly, your faith will need to be proved. Secondly, your faith is precious to God and to yourself. But just thirdly, your faith will actually end in sight. Which I thought, I quite like that. I like it a lot, actually. Your faith will end in sight. In this day and age, it says we walk by faith and not by sight. We can't see God. We can't see these things, these promises necessarily that he's given us. Can't see things like the gift of righteousness. But your faith will end in sight. Augustine, he said, faith is to believe what we do not see, and the reward of faith is to see what we believe. So the reward of faith is actually to see what we believe. Now that can be for the things that we're believing for in this life, but ultimately it's actually going to be what 1 Peter is talking about here, when the Lord returns, when we actually see him. Faith actually ends in this wonderful thing of actually seeing the one that we believe in. It's very, very cool. All right, so just in closing, I guess if you're struggling with something at the moment, I just encourage you to once again set your eyes on him who is unseen. It actually takes an act of our wills to think and remember, to renew our minds with the truth. Actually, no, I've got to actually live by faith. I've got to actually live by the one that I cannot see instead of the circumstances that are actually clouding in around me. And also, I guess if we've been getting complacent in our walk of faith, then again, we need to just remember how precious our faith is in our walk to God, but hopefully also to us. And to not allow these things to come in and to choke that faith, because there are many things, the Bible talks about that, that would actually want to sort of throttle your faith and produce, to stop any growth from happening. At the end of Hebrews 11, about halfway through, it says, all these people, talking about these heroes, says, we're still living by faith when they died. Which is quite cool. So it wasn't just something that they did right at the start and then went on about their lives. Faith was actually something that they lived by, and come the end of their lives, they were still finishing well, finishing the race well. So it's not just something that we start our Christian lives with. It's how we walk and how we want to finish strong in. All right, so next time we'll actually start looking, probably we'll go into the first person that's mentioned, which is Abel. We'll look at what he learnt by faith. And we'll carry on from there. So I'll just pray, and if anyone's got any comments like normal, that'll be good. Or anything you want to share, we'll have a time of open church. Obviously we've been apart for some time. There may be some things that people want to share, which would be great to hear. Father, I just thank you once again for the reminder that you give us in your word. Lord, of this great cloud of witnesses, as you say, that we have, that we can look to. Father, men and women who walked by faith, who trusted you through many different circumstances and difficulties. And Lord, most of all, we look and we thank you for the example that you gave us when you walked on this earth. For you're the ultimate hero, you're the ultimate example of how to walk by faith. May you help those that are here, Lord, who are struggling with difficulties. May you remind us all again of your promises and your faithfulness. And may you encourage us and strengthen us to walk in the faith that you have given us. We just praise your name and give you thanks in Jesus' mighty name. Amen.